You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret White,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Thor,
Corey Doctorow,
Brandon Sanderson,
Robin Mom,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is
Sadie Jones.
Thanks for tuning in to Author Stories today. We've got a fantastic show lined up for you. Before we get into that, I'd like to tell you about some sponsors today. Crystal Pico Watanabe at Pico's House. The Pico's House website now has a new look. She's got a team of 8 people who help provide services to fiction authors. And she has a full slate of services that now include beta reading. She's got 4 beta readers now. So if you're looking for beta reading services, she can definitely take on your project. Manuscript critique, developmental editing, line editing, copy editing, and proofreading. Authors can also inquire about putting their books in her Book Lovers Box, which is a monthly digital subscription box with a different theme each month. It's free to authors for a limited time. Be sure to check out Crystal and her whole team at Pico's House. That's PikkosHouse.com. Thanks, Crystal, for sponsoring the show. While Cape and Spandex movies are breaking box office records, comic book commentator and influencer Ed Gosney doesn't want us to forget the roots of these marvelous wonders. His blog, Cool Comics in My Collection, at edgosney.com, covers the gamut of four-color entertainment, from contemporary comic books to comics made for kids to bargain bin gold to classics that will transport you back in time. Comic books are a perfect blend of art and story, and Cool Comics captures the essence of what these funny books mean to us in a personal way. And make sure to join the Cool Comics in My Collection Facebook group, where members can interact, show off their prized comics, and have opportunities to win, you guessed it, Cool Comics. Published weekly, Cool Comics in My Collection aims to bring you a smile and reminds us why comic books are fun. Be sure to visit edgosney.com today. Speaking of superheroes and comics, my friend Patricia Gillum has a fantastic series called The Heroes of Corvus. It begins with book 1, a flight between a second-generation superhero named Red Bolt and a villain-for-hire named Icarus goes terribly wrong, resulting in the drowning deaths of 3 innocent civilians and orphaning a 6-year-old boy. Racked with guilt, Red Bolt visits Cameron Wilson at the hospital every night and won't leave the boy's side until he falls asleep. Befriended by a night shift nurse, the man in costume begins to disclose what really happened after the fight and why he feels the deaths of Cameron's parents and sister fall on his actions. A superhero didn't survive that night, and Cameron and the rest of the city aren't out of danger. This is such a phenomenal story. She has released up to part 4 now, and I cannot wait for part 5 to come out. If you're looking for a great adventure read that's on the cutting edge of what is in today's entertainment, The Heroes of Corvus is the series for you by Patricia Gillum. Thanks for tuning in. Be sure to go to HankGarner.com to subscribe to the show. We're on just about every platform you can imagine. Now stay tuned for our show. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm really excited to have Sadie Jones on the show with me. She has a phenomenal new book called The Snakes, and when you're hearing this, it'll be out available everywhere. Welcome to the show, Sadie.
Oh, thank you very much. It's lovely to be here.
Well, thank you for joining me. We begin each show with the same question, and that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
I don't have a memory of wanting to be one. I think my earliest memories would be writing. It was always the thing that I did and the thing I loved doing, but it was never an ambition so much as just, what would I do for a proper job while I was writing? So I remember writing a lot of stories and stories with pictures and plays when I was small. And then I got my first agent when I was 21 or 2, I think.
Wow. So just, I have this theory that people are born storytellers. And then if you choose to, pursue the path of a writer, then you know, that can be a separate thing. But I really think that there's a gene or a gift or however you want to, you know, call that. But I think some people are just born storytellers, and it sounds like you were born with that gift as well.
No, I agree with you, and I think I feel the same about actors and
exactly
artists. You just find particular. I mean, I was very lucky. Came from a creative. My father was a writer, so I've always thought there's a sort of mixture of nature and nurture in there. But where I'm always fascinated to hear about people who, just at the age of five, knew they wanted to act or write, and they came from something completely different, and their parents were farmers or builders or teachers, you know. And that really fascinates me.
It does me as well, and you know, that is the age old argument over nature versus nurture. And I've met equal amounts of people that were surrounded by creative people, and it just naturally came to them. And then, you know, there's that odd duck sometimes that just stands up in the middle of a family and says, I'm a writer. And they're like, oh, well, okay then. Were you an avid reader as a youngster?
Yes. And again, I think such a lucky generation, because there was so little else to do.
Right.
So we were either playing in the garden or reading or writing or making things, spaceships out of cardboard boxes. And it just, you know, I guess for hundreds of years, that was children's lives. There was not much, I mean, there was television, but it was, you know, not very amazing or interesting. And we had three channels until I was, you know, my late teens, I guess. So
exactly.
That's a real gift. I think boredom is the best thing for the mind.
Yes, it is. Was there a particular a book or series of books that just really kind of blew open your imagination and made you feel a part of the story?
The Narnia books were absolutely, you know, the C.S. Lewis, those books, when I remember, I mean, I would read them and reread them, and going through the wardrobe into the snow, C.S. Lewis has this extraordinary, really visceral, emotional, and they were very unfashionable in England at the time, because
really
it was the 70s, and you know, sort of liberal left wing. I remember people sort of go, "Oh, you know, they're about God, don't you?" Which, you know, I mean, there are worse things for books to be about, but I guess they thought that they were preachy, so they were, you know. They assumed that we were all going to read everything and that you could be picky about things. But, I mean, those books are absolute genius. And I wasn't thinking about the allegory, but I was in love with the morality. And I did, I think children, all of us need that, you know, how immediate and how urgent our need for good and bad and justice, particularly in children's books. And then as we get older, we're looking to understand things. And I think that's partly why those books are so enduring.
I had a similar experience with Narnia. And maybe in America, I think that attitude about the allegory of it maybe came later. Maybe that's a newer phenomenon. I'm not exactly sure. But I was also a kid of the 70s. And I remember loving those books and just being transported, you know, similarly to the kids in the wardrobe. It had a similar kind of visceral, you know, hold on me. And it wasn't until much later in life that I even allowed myself to think of the whole, allegorical nature of it. And was there a deeper meaning or, you know, sometimes not even deeper, sometimes just right there on the surface.
Yeah.
But to me, they were just fantastic stories. And I think that was Lewis's real gift, was to be able to bring us into that world without the baggage of interpreting all that. Maybe yes, it was there, but it was just magical.
It was, and it was about being your best self.
Right.
And the children, what was so wonderful? Do you remember how they lost their ages when they went to Narnia? They stopped being 8 or 13 or they just were people.
Right.
And that's such a profound thing to do in fiction, to be able to have the sort of true identity of the characters without them being hampered by being school children. So they were in battles and they were as strong as adults. There was no sort of boundary to their, to our imaginations reading them, I guess, which was amazing. Gosh, those books made me cry as well. The Last Battle. Oh, my goodness. Yeah, I love them. I still love them.
I know. Do you feel like that you've carried anything from those books or from the experience of those books into your writer life today?
Yes, I think that the books we read as children and sort of up until our mid-20s, you know, your those favorite books, I think they never leave you. And I have, I think, just deeply held beliefs in magical things that I have, you know, unicorns and all of those things which are as real to me as they probably, it's embarrassing. I should be embarrassed. I'm very bad at knowing what's real and what isn't generally. And I think that they've, and also the way that his language, the way that he wrote was very clean and very, it wasn't exactly the vernacular, but it was very immediate and chatty, sort of straight off the page, and his descriptions were, they weren't flowery, but they were so rich. So I think probably his prose influenced me.
Right. There's that's one reason I like to ask those kinds of questions to people, because I like you, believe that those early influences stick with us in one way or another, and the themes and the sometimes genre and those types of things come back around and influence the art that we make. And I just love to hear about those early influences.
And later in life, when you find grown-up books that you love, you know, I realized all his classical references and all the things that he, you know, all, that obviously he was brought up with Latin and Greek and all of those stories. So when you're reading your Shakespeare later and seeing all of those roots, that's a wonderful thing, because he was such an educator as well.
Right, exactly. Well, let's fast forward a little bit to when you started writing fiction. You said that it was just one of those things that you just always did, but at what point did you begin writing with the intention that the things that you were writing were going to go to a wide audience and that you were going to try your hand as a published author?
I was, I left school at 18. I did A-levels, which I guess with you is finishing high school. And then I didn't go to university, partly because I was just very bad at being educated, and I kind of knew that I was going to waste my time and behave badly, and I sort of wanted to experience life. Little did I know how I would, you know, adore the idea of 3 years off reading later on. But I went and did waitressing and traveling and different things. And I wrote a screenplay while I was living in Paris. I was teaching English as a foreign language and living in an attic, literally. And it was an extraordinary time, and I was quite lonely, and I wrote this screenplay that was, you know, the obvious semi-autobiographical thing about an experience I'd had. And I sent it to William Morris in London, and they took me on. So I kind of came whizzing back thinking, I thought I'd be Woody Allen, basically. That I would be that and William Goldman, you know. And then I just was semi-unemployed for years, actually learning how to do the job, which is a lifetime's thing. So it was a quick start, but then a kind of slow from then on.
Was that first book The Outcast?
No, The Outcast. So that was The Outcast. Was first a screenplay, and that was, almost 20 years after that, 15,
wow.
18 years maybe after that. So I was a screenwriter, unproduced, but sort of getting hired, having things in development, toiling, wanting to give up, not able to give up for years and years and years. And then when I was 38, and I had my husband and my children and all of that, wrote The Outcast as a film script, and then as a book.
What was the, you wrote it as a script first and then a book. What was the thought process that you went through to realize that this should be a novel and not necessarily for the screen?
Well, I think I was very alarmed by the idea of writing a novel, and I liked the idea of the collaboration of film. I was terrified of prose. So it was sort of, I was keeping myself safe by seeing myself as a dramatist in a way. And also I think it was such a training ground for making stories when you can't hide behind language. So but then The Outcast had just this extraordinary life to it, and I was so more obsessed by it, and it was running in my mind in a way that hadn't happened to me before, that was sort of almost alarming. And I just couldn't, the film script was in development and not getting anywhere. And people were saying how good it was, and then it was the basic development hell. And so I wrote the novel really to keep myself sane, because the childhood of the central character was unspooling in my mind, and I just had to put it down. So I thought I'd just have to write a book. I basically thought, I'm going to be failing in two areas now. You know, that's great. But then, by a happy coincidence, it was published, it was seen, and that was kind of that. And it did really, really well at home.
What's the story of The Outcast? What is that book about?
It's the story, it's set in the 1950s in sort of suburban, semi-rural England. It was a story about a very unhappy, damaged teenage boy who is considered unacceptable and terrible by everybody around him. And I thought the worst place to be a teenage boy would be 1950s Surrey in England. You know, he's barely heard of Elvis. And he witnesses his mother drowning early in his life, and his father is very repressed and ill-equipped to deal with it. And he grows up really just turning his pain on himself and not knowing how to manage. And it's the story of how he blossoms, eventually learns, you know, through wanting to look after the girl he has known from childhood who's having it in an abusive family. And when he discovers that, he discovers something other than his own pain, and he grows up. So it's really a coming-of-age story.
You said that you avoided writing the novel in the beginning, that it was you were really avoiding prose. After having this book finished and out, and then it finding an audience, what did that do for your writing confidence?
Oh, it's such a bizarre thing when that happens. I was so used to sort of writing in a vacuum and comforting myself or cheering myself up and, you know, being my own carrot and stick. But when that book happened, there was a bidding war over it. I mean, it wasn't a huge amount of money, but I mean, even one person wanting it was astounding. And then it won prizes, and it was a massive bestseller in Britain. And so I knew that I had to kind of start the next one really quickly. So luckily, I had started the second one before The Outcast came out, so that extraordinary flip of experience where everything changed for me, I was already, I had one foot in another world in my next book, so I was slightly cushioned from it. And I think what happens is the demons that you have at one point in your life, you know, before I was published, the demons were, you'll never get anywhere. This will, you know, you're probably not good enough. No one will ever see this. And then they immediately switch. They don't go away. They just turn into, it won't be as successful as the next, as the last one, you know. This one will never do what the first one did. It'll be the disappointing second novel. So whatever you do, you have these demons on your shoulder when you're working that you have to learn to put aside.
You know, we talk a lot on the show about the gift of anonymity that comes with writing the first novel, and how that before that novel is out there, no one knows that you're writing it. No one's expecting it. There are no expectations on you other than, you know, self-imposed ones. But then after that first book comes out, especially if it's a success, then, like you said, there comes a whole different level of pressure and expectations that come with that. And, how do you deal with that to make it through that, to kind of solidify in your mind, okay, this is what I'm supposed to be doing. I can do this. And you know, so what if the second book is, you know, doesn't do what the first one does? This is still my life's work.
Well, what's the phrase you use? The gift of anonymity.
Yes.
It's a wonderful phrase. That's so exactly right. And you don't realize what a gift it is until you get there, where suddenly you're not alone in your study. You feel like there are eyes on it. And that it's like having sort of the lights put up in the auditorium and suddenly seeing everyone staring at you. It's horrible. But I suppose what I do consciously now, with it, and it's part of the discipline, just, you know, dealing with the demons, is just, I'm lucky in one way, because I don't have like a 2-book deal or a 3-book deal. I go book by book. So I can say to myself with some conviction, nobody need ever see this. And I say that to myself every time I start work. And I'll sort of sit down and I just think, it's fine. Sometimes I'll have to write with my eyes closed because I'm self-conscious. But I'll just think, you know, who cares, you know, so this could be terrible. Otherwise you can't take the risks. You know, you have to write the thing you must never write, I think.
Right.
You know.
I can only imagine what that pressure is like for someone who's writing a long-standing series and one that readers become so invested in characters and sometimes readers know more about the characters than the writers do, it seems, you know, that they take such care with every little detail. I love that idea of each book just allowing the book to be its own thing and, you know, each book has its own journey.
Yes, exactly. And thinking, you know, well, and there's also when you're writing, there's sort of two states, I think. There's one, which is this is just absolutely horrible and I've got a long way to go and I would never dream of showing it to anyone. And then there's the other one where I just have to show it to someone. Someone has to see this. Someone has to read it. You might not think it's wonderful, but you feel compelled to have other people look at it. And then, you know, what can you do then? You take your chances.
Is there a moment in the writing where the story becomes alive and takes on a life of its own and where it becomes bigger than you are and bigger than your control, and you just kind of stand back and become part of the process along with the book?
Yes, those are the bits you really hope and pray for. I feel, you know, that I'm most of the time just pedaling and struggling and trying to get the engine started and doing all the what I call the maths of the story and trying to, you know, get my structure and make it seem as though it's alive and on fire and all those things. And then there's this wonderful moment or series of moments where it has its own life and its own energy. And suddenly you're, oh, okay. Now, I mean, I've the best bit when and what I really struggled to achieve is the feeling of transcribing the thing that I'm seeing or that's already happened. So when I write, I spend a lot of time picturing a scene or a conversation or a place and then trying to describe it rather than, I always feel I'm in trouble if I'm making it up on the page. So that I tend to work that way around. But sometimes if that's not happening, I just have to write through and wait for it to catch light that way.
When you start imagining a new story, and maybe it's a novel, maybe it's a screenplay, whatever, what usually comes to you first? Is it a character? Is it a setting? Is it maybe a provocative headline that you know read earlier? What's usually the genesis for the kernel of the story that begins to grow?
It can be all or any of the above. It's each one has its own different. With the uninvited guest, it was, I had a dream about a house, and I woke up and I thought, I've dreamt that same house before, but it was at a different time in history, and there were different people there. And it was suddenly like sort of being given a present. I thought, oh, okay. Oh, well, right, that's a book. That's if that house exists, then I need to find a story for that house. And with The Outcast, it was the phrase, I think there's something wrong with him. There's something wrong with him, just kept going around my mind. And that sort of gave birth to the character, and then I built the story around him. With Small Wars, it was the news. It was Afghanistan and Iraq. And all the stories of war crimes that were coming out, torture, and that got me thinking. And with Fallout, I don't remember what started that out. I'm not sure. But they all have a different spark.
Right. And maybe it's good that you don't remember the spark. That just means that the story became so alive, it's its own thing.
Yeah. Let's put it that way. Let's say it was that.
Your new book, The Snakes, which is out available now when people are hearing this, is really, in a lot of ways to me, a hearkening back to Narnia in this story of it's kind of this bigger story within a story, and kind of these ideas and themes of good and evil. And I can definitely see that influence in this book, and maybe not on the surface, but as we talk about it, I can see that. Where did this book begin for you?
That's so interesting you say that. I hadn't thought of that at all, but of course, yes. It was 2016, and I knew it was going to be in France, and that it was a good and evil story, and in some ways a morality tale, which was sort of alarming. and then I was in a state of sort of rage and frustration with the news, and I knew that I originally wanted to set it in the 1930s in Europe because of the good and evil and the sort of rise of evil. And then I thought, well, we all know how that turned out. And the thing about the modern world with all of the dreadful things that are happening, and the polarity of and different movements and different things, and the unsettled politics across Europe and everywhere, I needed to have that sense of urgency that I had and have of waking up in the morning and not knowing what's going to happen next. So it had to be a contemporary book. So then I ditched 30s Europe and made it modern, and then found my characters for it, really through the sins and the virtues. There's a lot of allegory in the book. Those building blocks were sort of, now you're talking about Narnia, of course, those building blocks of you know, sin and transgression and all of that stuff was there as sort of the pillars of it.
Did it surprise you when you changed the setting to a modern setting and the story started working, started clicking? Did that surprise you that it was easier to tell that story now?
It was the thing that made it come alive, and sort of took it out of the freezer. It was a relief. Yeah, probably a surprise. I think there was again relief because it felt very ambitious. I was very nervous of writing a The Way We Live Now novel. I've never wanted to do that. And so really the job of it was to find a way of making that, coming at that sideways, making that's, you know, it's a thriller essentially. It's in many ways, it's horror. I wanted it to be, as human and small a story. You know, it's about a marriage and this young married couple. And so I needed to hide all of those huge themes in the small story of those people and that family. And that was really when it took off.
Tell us about the character of Bea, that is kind of the central character. Where did she come from, and what is her struggle in the story?
Bea is, she's a good person, which is a nightmare to write. She, villains, you know, they're full of chat, and you can make people sympathize with them against their will, and you know, all of that. But a good person, she was very difficult, and I loved her, and I found her frustrating to write because she is so unforgiving of herself. She has very high moral standards, and sort of coupled with low self-esteem. But I felt this tremendous loyalty to her because I think that she felt very much, I would think, you know, here I am writing this good person. She's doing and saying things that we are all, most of us, doing and saying in everyday life. We all want people to be nicer to each other. We all want to be more forgiving. We all, you know, feel essentially generous and put upon by people behaving badly around us. And writing that was unbelievably hard because feeling that is so universal. But she was really tough to write, and I hope I did her justice.
Well, the book, The Snakes, is, like we said, out available everywhere now. When you have a story that is this emotional and this dark in a lot of places, but then there are moments of levity in it. Is that a conscious effort when you're writing to realize, okay, this has been pretty deep for a while. Let's let the reader off the hook for just a minute. Is that something that you plan through, or is it just part of you as the writer that begins to come out?
I'm not sure how I would unravel that knot. I think it's both things. It's partly instinct. It's partly my own, you can have had enough of a thing. You begin to feel worn down by it. So I suppose it's a story instinct. The marriage, which is Beatrice and Dante, so she's Bea and he's Dan. And he is the very human side of it. And she is, you know, what a lot of women go through a lot, being the good one, the one who's being inspiring and generous and, you know, the light and the flame for him to follow. And so their relationship and their marriage kind of provided, I think, some of what you're talking about, that some of the laughs and the interaction between them. They're having a pretty difficult time, but they're very, they have some humor about it, I think.
Yeah. Well, and sometimes it really puts an exclamation point on some of the darkness when you can have a little wry laugh about it. There's something about dark humor that speaks to some twisted sense in all of us, maybe.
No, absolutely. And as you say, yeah. It is a really dark book. And it's about grief. A lot of the book is about grief. And the two things that I have observed personally about grief is, one, that it is like being in a very dark thriller where you feel hunted down. And that's what the book feels like, I think. And felt like to write. And the other is that you laugh at the weirdest things, and it's rather surreal and heightened. So it was a challenge to go that dark and to be truthful about what that's like, you know.
Yeah. Well, you say that the book is about grief, and it definitely is, and you get that sense as a reader. But when you're writing, sometimes you don't know what the story is about until the end. And then you start kind of reading back over and putting the pieces together and you say, oh, I see where I was going here. Even if it was just your subconscious mind that was taking you there. And then you, with your analytical mind, piece it together afterward. Is there ever a moment in the book, in the writing, that you, that the threads start coming together and you're like, oh, okay, I know what this is now? Or is it just the journey of the writing and then it all comes together afterward?
That's really well expressed. I don't think I'll be so articulate about it. I think I always know my ending. So I know what I'm aiming for, and I'm never surprised by that. But where I am surprised, or where I do get lost, or where I'm trying to find it, and often those paths will go off in different directions, and I'll have to, you know, cut 50 pages and go back to the last bit where it worked. All of that happens in the middle, but I always I know where I'm trying to get, and I know that my ending is going to do exactly what you said, describe, frame the story retrospectively and make sense of it all. And this book, having it dodges about a lot, and it sets up expectations and then confounds them. So that was a real challenge to do, knowing where I was going with it.
Right. Well, Sadie, I absolutely love the book, and I love what you're doing. The Snakes is phenomenal. It's one of those books that will linger with you for a while afterwards, and I love what you're doing. If there's a place, is there a place online where people can connect with you if they want to learn more about you and maybe follow along with new news and all of that good stuff?
Yes, I'm on Twitter. That's Sadie Jones, and Instagram, that's Sadie Jones, and then my in this country it would be HarperCollins. They would have an author page for me, and in the UK it's Random House, Penguin Random House Chateau Book. So if anyone looks, they can definitely find me.
Excellent. We're going to send everyone to follow you and to pick up the new book. Sadie, thank you so much for taking time to come on the show today.
Thank you very much indeed.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Author Stories. Go to hankgarner.com to find all of the archives of the show, and be sure to subscribe while you're there. Now stay tuned for a special audiobook clip from Richard Gleaves, the Jason Crane series.
The ancient building wore the severe cassock colors of a Puritan minister, a uniform monochrome of slate-gray shingles and soot-gray clapboards, its shadowed upper windows cross-hatched like the facets of a spider's eye. The second story protruded beyond the first and bore the house's only ornament, two gray teardrops of wood, weeping from each corner of the building's stiff upper lip. The place would have looked sinister and foreboding in its shadowed alley if not for the die-cut silhouette of a dancing sheep, jaunty above the door, and the two front bay windows that blazed with colorful, welcoming light. The windows were hung with orbs of colored glass on staggered lengths of ribbon. Each orb glowed with autumnal reds and delicate greens, burgundy tints and pumpkin hues, dappled raspberry and clover lime, streaked with light and weightless as bubbles over a cauldron. The shelves below offered crystal skulls and silver daggers and horny devils, Celtic chalices and woven dream catchers in dreamcoat hues. A primitive broom leaned in a corner, ready for flight, and a rhapsodic nude in bronze clutched her goat-legged lover beneath a jackal bust of Anubis. The interior of the shop was even witchier. Above a crude and sooty fireplace, a stack of brick barely holding the shape of a chimney pushed through the barn-high roof, threading ancient beams that crisscrossed overhead. Brooms and kettles and Christmas lights dangled from these, alongside Halloween costumes and Chinese umbrellas, pointy hats and bundles of herbs. Jason wandered deeper into the shop. His fingers trailed across strange bronze statuary and Aztec masks of turquoise and lapis lazuli. He rolled his eyes at the luck candles and money charms, but goggled indecently at a nude and anatomically correct silver nymph with long golden hair that reminded him of Kate.
"See anything you like?"
Jason jumped, turned, and jumped again. The woman standing before him was the living embodiment of every hippy-dippy counterculture type he'd ever seen. Her hair was green, her face pale and round, her doughy body wrapped in some elaborately woven ethnic garb. Her eyebrows were black and pierced in little rows, and her eyes were heavily circled with midnight blue, as if she'd been sucker-punched by an oil slick. She tapped the glass over the nymph.
Admiring the goddess, I see.
She'd practically caught him with porn.
You want to hold her? She won't break. Here.
The woman flipped open a glass door and handed Jason the naked figure.
See how heavy she is? You could bang her against the wall all day and barely make a dent.
She waggled her eyebrows, obviously enjoying his discomfort. He checked the price tag.
$700? The goddess is a symbol of love and fertility. Don't be ashamed of desiring her.
The woman's long green fingernails plucked a long black cigarette from a long red case, and she lit it.
I sense,
she blew smoke and studied its whorls.
Dissatisfaction in love? Yes, I have just the thing.
She pulled Jason into a side room where the smell of her clove smoke gave way to the skunky aromas of potpourri sachets, tea leaves, and hanging clutches of twiggy flowers. She searched, found a little bundle, and pressed it into his hand.
This will make you irresistible. Rub it on your nethers twice a day, and love shall surely find you.
Jason made a face. The bundle smelled like cow manure. He didn't even want that on his hands.